Hi, this is episode 58 of K. Ray Reads to You. Today we have chapter 8 of The Applestone by Nicholas Stewart Gray. Chapter 8 is called The Muddled Image. Wednesday afternoon was technically a holiday, but unfortunately we were compelled to play school games. Everyone insisted it was good for us. I never could see why. None of us enjoyed them, with the possible exception of Douglas, who tended to regard them as pitched battles, and usually emerged looking as if he'd been in one. I always managed to collect at least 3 reprimands for thinking of something else at moments of crisis, and Nigel played by fits and starts, and was generally sent off for arguing. I don't know how Joe and Missy got on at their school, but they didn't seem to take it all quite so seriously. We came back to an early tea, feeling exhausted with rushing about for the good of our health. Joe said a brisk walk would have been just as much use and less trying. Douglas, with a rapidly blackening eye, said it wouldn't have encouraged the team spirit in us. I wondered how he'd displayed this virtue by throwing his own center forward flat on his face and stepping on him. Anyway, we all agreed that it had been a waste. Whoops! Anyway, we all agreed that it had been a bad waste of Applestone time. And I suggested we should go out to the old stable. It was behind the house, and was used to store the lawn mower, the big rotary grass cutter, and various other implements of a like nature, together with all their fuel and oil. Before we found the stone, we had started making a guy in there, to be ready for the 5th of November. I know we'd begun a bit early, but we enjoyed the task, and we kept making alterations and improvements. We'd got some straw, and made it into the shape, more or less, of a human, by lashing it around with lengths of old binder twine, donated by Mr. Dobbs, in a fit of generosity. Mum had just given us a sweater of Douglas's, which was too battered to be worn by anyone, even him. And we put it on the guy, with some difficulty, but ultimate success. Nigel sat on an upturned bucket, and went on with the stiff paper mask he was making. He'd got some combings from the cart horse's mane, and was shaping these into a beard and mustache, and sticking them into place. Douglas suddenly announced that he wished the guy to be named after him. "My sweater makes up a good half of it," he insisted, "and you wouldn't have got it if I hadn't stretched that last hole till it ripped the whole side." Joe said he shouldn't have. "Why do you want to be burned?" said Missy. "It would be fun." I told him he had a strange sense of humor, and Nigel said he couldn't make the mask hideous enough to represent Douglas. Joe said firmly that the guy was meant to be Guy Fawkes, not Douglas MacDonald, so he could just keep out of it. "Apart from all that," I said, "I suggest that we bring the guy to life." And I explained that I wanted to know some things about the gunpowder plot, why they made such a mess of it, for instance. "A child of 3 could have done a better job," I said. "It would be interesting to know," said Joe thoughtfully, "and I agree to the idea." "Well, I don't," said Missy. "Not unless it has a face." I saw what she meant. "Hurry with that mask, Nigel," I told him. He said it was not a thing to be knocked off in a rush. He then put a bit of its beard in the center of its forehead. He said, "Now look what I'd made him do." He tore off the horsehair and dabbed some bright green paint on the smear it left behind. He then said I'd muddled him. And he flicked on some bright yellow to prove his point. "You're supposed to be doing a portrait of Guy Fawkes," said Joe, "not a monster from Mars." "Well, stop hurrying me," he growled. "It's getting monstrous because of Douglas saying it was to be like him." "Oh, come on," said Joe, "hand it over. It's all right as it is. No one expects a mask to be a great work of art." He said it was a great work of art. And Joe hooked it neatly out of his hand and tied it around the blob of straw that was the head with some ribbons that were glued to the paper. The general effect began to look a bit sinister, and I had a sudden qualm. "All masks are sinister," said my sister when I said so. "It's the empty eyes. But it won't be like this when it comes alive."
"I hope not."
I took the apple stone from its bag.
"Are you quite sure you know what you're doing?" it remarked.
But I was thinking of something else, wondering about the ease with which the gunpowder plot had been discovered, and whether the official version was really the true one. And I ignored the apple stone's doubts and touched it against the stiff, gloved hand of the guy.
"Ah," said Douglas in a gloating voice, "let's have a fire, a great big burning hot fire. Is there any explosive?"
"Are you crazy?" said Joe.
I came back to reality, saw that Douglas had gone very white, and was staring at the guy in horror.
"I didn't speak," said he.
Missy squeaked loudly and then said,
It talks like Douglas."
And the mouth of the mask opened again, and from it came the voice of our cousin.
"Come, why do you wait? It's a chilly wind, and a fire would warm our bones. Your bones, I should say, for I seem to have none."
And it gave a wild laugh that chilled my spine, for it sounded like Douglas at his very worst. Yet the talking mask was just paper with cut-out eyes. The guy was still an effigy of straw and string, only the mouth was moving, and one rigid hand that rose and fell as if moved by clockwork. Now, as we stood staring in dismay, the thing began to change, very slowly, and bit by bit. The mask blurred, and became a human face, a man's face, with the dapplings of bright paint on the forehead paling until they looked more like a bruise. It was not unlike the portraits of Guy Fawkes, except for the frighteningly familiar blue eyes and short black hair.
"I said you'd muddled me," said Nigel defensively. "I got to Douglas into it by mistake."
"Have you veins of ice?" demanded the guy. "Does none of you feel the cold?"
"It's freezing. I must have fire. I must be warm."
Its voice had deepened. The straw bundle had thickened inside the old sweater, and now its legs seemed to be wearing boots and breeches. On its hands, my old woolen gloves that the moths had gnawed had become leather gauntlets, but the moth holes still showed. Through a tear in the breeches, I saw wisps of straw. The apple stone mumbled something from its bag around my neck. Should have waited till it was finished.
"I don't like it," said Missy loudly.
The guy had lurched to its feet and stood peering around the stable. Now it said, "Shall we light our fire?"
"Don't keep on about it," I said. "Are you Guy Fawkes?"
"Yes, in a way, here and there, and from time to time. But other personalities seem to be crowding in. What's in those kegs?"
"The gasoline drums?" said Joe.
"Well, fuel for the mowers, and the paraffin is for the greenhouse heater."
"Inflammable?" asked the guy eagerly.
"Yes, very."
"Good, good. We'll need it all."
The guy stalked stiffly across to stare at the stuff with a keen and covetous eye.
"You leave it alone," said Joe in alarm. "It's dangerous."
"Good, good," said the guy again. "I love danger. It's like a game to me, and a game can be like a battle, and a battle can end in disaster. Does it matter? Life is short, and might as well finish in a blaze, eh, my friend?" he said, turning on Douglas.
Douglas looked uncertain. The guy was saying things with which he agreed, but was saying them in his voice, and he didn't care for this.
None of us did.
The guy laughed, and then spoke in the tone of a child, of Missy.
"I love fireworks, all those stars pouring down the sky, and the bangs and the wheels of light."
It began to sing. "Remember, remember, the 5th of November." My little sister clutched my sleeve and said in a terrified whisper,
"It's me. It's because my old hair ribbon is holding its face on."
The guy overheard this, for he now said indignantly,
"You leave my face alone. It's a very fine face."
I heard Nigel gasp, I said, "Stop it! Why do you keep changing so? Who are you really?"
"I don't quite know," said the guy, looking at us with the blue eyes of Douglas. "I get a sort of glimmer, but then it all fades. My mind goes wandering, and I seem to be doing nothing but wool gathering."
It waved its hands, where the moth-holes of my gloves showed clearly, and it had spoken in my voice.
"If it does me," said Joe passionately, "I shall go mad."
"No, you won't, dear," said the guy, smiling at her. "You must make allowances for a creature with a mixed nature. Everyone is a mixture, you know, and I'm more so than most, owing to my haphazard composition. You must try to be understanding and polite."
He'd ended on a rather prim note, and Douglas laughed nervously.
"There," he said to Joe, "it did imitate you, and you didn't go mad."
"It wasn't me," she cried. "I don't talk in that prissy way. I don't. I know I don't."
"Now you know better," said Douglas.
"You don't do it often," soothed Missy.
Joe looked just about ready to weep with vexation.
"And apart from all that," said the guy, and I winced, "where shall we make the bonfire?"
"Let's get out of here anyway," I said feebly. As I opened the stable door, the wind blew in, and the guy shivered and said it was going to snow. I said it was only slightly chilly, being an autumn evening. The guy said the English climate was awful. Then it added, in a much deeper tone, that once he had gone abroad to get away from it.
"But it wasn't any warmer in the Netherlands," said he. "Spain was where I'd really meant to go when I joined the Spanish army, but the best fighting was in the Low Countries, so I was stuck there."
"Mr. Fox," I said.
"Yes, my lad."
"Why did you ever get embroiled in that mad plot? You were a competent soldier, weren't you? Experienced and all that."
"Certainly I was. I left my home in Yorkshire when I was 23 to earn myself a reputation as a fighter, and that I succeeded in doing. And 11 years later came Thomas Winter with a tale of wrongs, and invited me to join a conspiracy. Mad, you call it, son? But in its madness lay its best chance of success. Most plots are, by the very nature of them, underhand affairs. Ours was to be carried out with dash and boldness, and to end in one great bang, a rush of fire and sparks, the scent of smoke and powder."
His voice had risen excitedly. I saw the mark on his forehead turn greener, and a bit of straw appeared through the rent on his sleeve. I said sternly, "No, no. Think of being a soldier, Mr. Fox. Think of how you came back to England."
"What? Oh, yes."
The paper look left his face, and his voice deepened again. "Back to England, yes, where the Scots King and the Protestant Parliament were busy breaking their promises and persecuting the people of my faith."
"What about the persecuting the Spanish were doing in Holland?" I said.
Guy Fawkes stared at me in some surprise.
"You can't go looking at other points of view in an argument," said he.
"Why not?"
"Well, think of a battle, for instance. How could it start if you began by considering the views of the enemy?"
"Easy," said Douglas. "Consider their point of view, and then bash them."
"Waste of time," said Mr. Fox. "Better to bash without thinking."
And he gave Douglas's own wild laugh.
"Mr. Fox," I said rapidly. "Now, Mr. Fox, you were an expert on mining and explosives, weren't you?"
He said yes.
"There's nothing like the thrill of laying a charge under the walls of some unsuspecting foe," said he. "And then, when they think there's no danger, wham! Lovely!"
He gave a sudden shiver and crossed to the open door.
"Jeremy, don't be so mean," he said. "I want a fire."
It was horrible to hear the voice of Missy, with the whine in it that she used when she was trying to aggravate you into doing something she wanted. I saw the tall figure standing there, and the straw sticking out of the tops of his leather boots. Then he gave a curious, high whicker of laughter.
"I know where to light my fire," he yelled.
He snatched up a drum of paraffin under one arm and vanished outside.
"That laugh wasn't any of us," said Joe.
"It was the guy itself," said Nigel. "I mean, the guy that isn't Mr. Fox, the one we're making for the bonfire, the guy with a small g."
"Come on," I said urgently.
We raced out of the stable. It took us some time to run the creature to earth, and even then it was only the smell of burning that gave it away.
"It's in the big barn," cried Joe.
"Gosh, all that straw and stuff," said Douglas.
"Stop," I said. "Don't go in there. The whole place may go up like a bomb. If he sets that paraffin off..."
"The calves are in there," wailed Joe. "And Bob. Oh, quick."
She shot into the open door of the barn, and the rest of us followed her.
Mr. Fox, or the guy, one couldn't be sure which, was squatting beside a small pile of straw and chuckling to it, or himself, fumbling with a little box. As we came up, a spark flashed from it and lit for 1 second the sharp-nosed face bent over it.
"Stop it, you stupid thing," cried Joe angrily. "If you set light to that straw, I'll never forgive you."
"It's wet. It's hard to light."
And the creature gave its high cackle again and struck another spark.
"You're hateful," said Missy fiercely, "and I wish I hadn't given you my ribbon."
Douglas suddenly went behind the guy and gave it a great shove that sent it toppling forward. The little box went flying, and Nigel snatched it up.
"It's a tinderbox," I said. "Where did that come from?"
"Oh, Jeremy, where did the boots and the gloves come from? They belong to Mr. Fox," said Joe.
"Correct, my dear," said the guy.
It sat up. My cousins moved away cautiously, and it gave an amiable grin at us all, and was Mr. Fox again.
"You play roughly," said he, rubbing his shoulder. "You took me by surprise. And why? Surely you don't think I'd light a fire in this place, with all this hay and straw lying around. You must take me for a rare fool."
"You vary," I said.
"To the extent of total insanity," said he amusedly, "though I must admit, in another manner, I've always enjoyed playing with fire."
"I do too," said Douglas.
The soldier gave him a pleasant look. He said if Douglas had been his assistant, the plot might have been a success. I thought he was probably right, or else a young MacDonald would have come to a sticky end along with the rest of the conspirators.
"They were such amateurs," said Mr. Fox.
He got to his feet and began to pace rather restlessly about the floor of the great barn. One of the calves lowed, and he lowed back at it. Then he said in a feeling way, "Never get embroiled with amateurs. Their enthusiasm is only equaled by their incompetence. If they'd left it all to me..."
He suddenly sniffed.
"I smell burning."
"No, you don't," Joe assured him. "It's just a bit of charred tinder in your box. Please go on about your plot."
"The smell of smoke," said the guy in a whisper. "The rage and heat of a blaze. It makes everything worthwhile. Can't we light just a small..."
He rustled as he moved, as though he was stuffed with straw. Well, he was.
"Mr. Fox," I said loudly, "Mr. Fox, your leader hired a house next to the Parliament buildings."
"What? Oh, yes, yes, he did."
"And you tunneled from a cellar there."
"Yes."
"Why didn't you finish the tunnel?"
"It leaked," said the soldier. "One day we found ourselves knee-deep in water, either seeping in from the Thames itself or from some tributary stream, I don't know which. We were cold, cold. It was very cold."
"Yes, yes," I said, "and so because of this leak, you had to put your kegs of powder in another cellar, and everything started to go wrong."
"You were betrayed," said Douglas indignantly, "by one of your own men, Tresham, the rat."
"No, he wasn't," said Mr. Fox. "He certainly sent a message warning his brother-in-law not to attend the opening, but he didn't mean to betray anything. He was stupid, but brave, and he went to his death in prison for it."
Then he grinned under his rakish mustache and gave a bright glance around at us all.
"Do you care that our plan failed?" said he. Are you of our party?"
"We're not on any side particularly," I told him. "Things have changed in England. People don't go blowing up anyone who annoys them."
"It wasn't very nice of you," put in Joe. "Didn't you mind about the Queen and the young prince? You knew they'd be there too."
The soldier murmured something about not making omelets without breaking eggs.
"I'm glad your plot failed," said Joe, "but I'm sorry you were caught. I wish you'd been able to escape."
"So do I," said he, and took his tinderbox from Nigel. We all made a move towards him.
"'Tes all right, me dears," said he, in a thickening Devon accent. "I won't have me fire here in the barn, since you'm afraid."
And he went out of the door in a stiff whirl of movement and a rustle of straw. We were struck motionless for a moment, and Missy said, "That was the string talking. Mr. Dobbs' bit of string."
"Oh, come on," cried Joe. "We've got to find him again, or he may..."
It was dark by now, and there was no sign of our guy anywhere. We searched the barnyard, and our own garden, and then the orchard, with no sound or scent to guide us. We were hurrying toward the stable when I heard a small, high singing. It came from the paddock. When we got there, the guy was hopping around the heap of twigs and branches we'd started to pile up for the big bonfire that we always had on the 5th. It was chanting as it hopped and skipped, in a high, childish voice. "Remember, remember, the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot." We came up out of breath and apprehensive, and it stopped capering and waved its hands at us.
"All this lovely wood," it said happily. "You've got all this lovely wood together, just for me. Oh, how kind and thoughtful you are."
It jumped up and down and clapped its clumsy hands together.
"I see no reason," it sang, "why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot."
"Have you forgotten?" said Joe.
"I," it said, coming to an abrupt halt.
"Forgotten what?"
"The gunpowder plot."
"No, no, one doesn't quite forget." I sighed with relief at the deepening note in his voice. I rather liked Mr. Fox, though he was a bit wild and ruthless. He said regretfully, "All that work, all that thought, the high hopes, and every moment of the time we were being watched and didn't know it. They knew all about our plot right from the start, but they didn't step in too soon. Oh no, they were much too crafty. They gave us the rope we needed to hang ourselves, with all the trimmings. They had their watchers to see us bring the kegs up river by barge. By all the saints," he cried, "we were carrying them on our shoulders across the open street, exchanging greetings with the watch. Watch, indeed, they were watching us each step of the way. And then, when all was ready and set, the night before the convening of Parliament, and the kegs sitting snugly in their cellar under their house, and me sitting snugly on the kegs, then they made their pounce, and all was over."
"I'm so sorry," said Joe. "For you, I mean."
"Poor Mr. Fox," said Missy. "It was not a pleasant ending," he said, "for any of us. And they got us all, as they intended, by awaiting the moment when we were committed to the full. Ah, well, I should have known better than to involve myself with amateurs. Plotting is an art, and they merely muddled it with ideas."
"Art shouldn't ever be muddled," said Nigel with conviction.
"You're perfectly right, boy," said the soldier. He sighed and stretched his arms as though they were cramped. "If it's any comfort," I said, "your name is remembered with a certain amount of affection. The fires are still lit on the 5th of November in memory of you. They may have begun for different reasons, but there's no malice any more. People think of you as a brave man."
"Thank you," he said quietly. "A bright flame is a good memorial."
His voice lifted. I saw some straw over the cuff of his raised arm. He said, "There's a cold wind blowing through me. Light my fire now." None of us said anything until Joe spoke in a sympathetic way. "Poor creature, it can't matter if we light its fire, Jeremy. It isn't a big one."
"Oh, yes," said Douglas. "Do let's."
I thought about it. While I was thinking,
Douglas took a box of matches from his pocket and struck one. Nigel got a bit of drawing paper from his pocket and held it into the flame, and it caught light. My cousins stuffed it under the shavings and straw at the bottom of the bonfire. There was a flare and a crackle. I looked at Mr. Fox, and he was the guy with a small G. Its paper mask was grinning wildly, and it wagged its gloved hands with glee. Bits of straw stuck through the holes in its green sweater. It said shrilly, "Oh, splendid! What a perfect picture! If one could only paint it!" Nigel coughed self-consciously. He'd often had a try at painting fire, and failed. "Do stand farther back, all of you, away from the sparks." It was Joe's voice, but my sister had not spoken. "I love playing with fire," said Douglas. But Douglas stood tight-lipped and still. "Apart from all that," said the guy, "it must be better to think too much than too little." "That's what I say," I began, and bit my tongue. Now the bonfire was well alight. The flames sprang high into the air, and the smoke of them was painted red and yellow from underneath. Sparks flew everywhere. It was as bright as day in the corner of the paddock. I saw the grave faces of my relatives, and the white grinning mask of the guy. It gave a high yell. "Oh, my fire! Partner me! Dance with me! Give me the glory and the ecstasy! The stars raining down around me! The voices of children singing!" It gave a huge leap into the air, and landed right in the center of the flames. We all took a step forward and stopped, and then we began to sing for the guy. As the flames died into ashes, the scent of wood smoke blew away on the wind, and the singing stopped. Father came out of the house to see what we were doing. We said it had been a mistake, really. He said, well, it was our own work that we'd destroyed, and herded us. We didn't really mind. It had gotten chilly outside. And that's the end of chapter 8. See you next time.